we call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution.
It was 2 years ago this week that 250 leaders from Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island communities gathered at Australia's Red Centre at the sacred site of Uluru to try to come up with a united position on the way forward for national reconciliation. More specifically, the recognition of Australia's First Nation people in the foundational document of Australia's democracy, our Constitution. And they did. The result of their efforts over those 4 days was a 439-word Uluru Statement of the Heart, addressed not to Parliament, but to all Australian people, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous.
It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination.
The statement called for a voice for Indigenous people to be enshrined in the Constitution and hence in the decision-making processes of government. But then Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, having kick-started the process of consultation that led to the statement, dismissed it out of hand.
That is not a model that is desirable, and moreover, it would have, in our judgment, no prospect at all of being successful in a referendum.
2 years on, and with little progress since, Indigenous leaders are now looking to the newly re-elected Morrison government to finally take up the torch. Next year, Australians will commemorate the 250th anniversary of Captain James Cook's arrival on this continent and the claiming of it for the British Crown. Many think it fitting 2020 should also be the year that Australians recognise our first people in our Constitution.
People want treaty. They don't want acknowledgement, they want treaty, and they want truth, a Truth and Justice Commission.
This is Please Explain. I'm Jessica Irvine, filling in for Tori Maguire. Later on, we'll hear from the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, Lisa Davies, about why our newspapers are getting behind the momentum for a referendum. But first, I've got two very special guests joining me for this week's episode. Megan Davis is a Cobble Cobble woman and director of the Indigenous Law Centre, University of New South Wales. She was intimately involved in the statement and was the first person to read it out loud 2 years ago. Also joining me is Stan Grant, a Wiradjuri and Kamilaroi man and Professor of Global Affairs at Griffith University. Now, many listeners will remember Stan's passionate speech delivered in 2015 on racism in modern Australia.
In 1963, when I was born, I was counted among the flora and fauna, not among the citizens of this country. Now, you will hear things tonight, you will hear people say, but you've done well. Yes, I have, and I'm proud of it. And why have I done well? I've done well because of who has come before me, my father, who lost the tips of three fingers working in sawmills to put food on our table because he was denied an education. My grandfather, who served to fight wars for this country when he was not yet a citizen and came back to a segregated land where he couldn't even share a drink with his digger mates in the pub because he was black. My great-grandfather, who was jailed for speaking his language to his grandson, my father, jailed for it. My grandfather on my mother's side, who married a white woman who reached out to Australia, lived on the fringes of town until the police came, put a gun to his head, bulldozed his tin humpy, and ran over the graves of the three children he buried there. That's the Australian dream. I have succeeded in spite of the Australian dream, not because of it, and I've succeeded because of those people.
Very powerful stuff there. Now, Stan, you've agreed to do something of an encore for us, and I think this, I'm really excited. I think this is really special. We've been talking a lot this week about the Uluru Statement, but I have to confess that I actually hadn't read it until this week. Many Australians won't have actually heard the words spoken, and you've agreed to read it out for us. It's only about 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah.
I would just encourage listeners, maybe just take a moment and listen to these words. This is the message to Australia from those 250 leaders who came together and wanted to say something to you, the Uluru Statement.
We gathered at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did, according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom, remain attached thereto, and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished, and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. How could it be otherwise that peoples possessed a land for 60 millennia, and this sacred link disappears from world history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood. Proportionally, we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are aliened from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is the torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional reforms to empower our people and take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our destiny, our children will flourish. They will walk in two worlds, and their culture will be a gift to their country. We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Makarrata is the culmination of our agenda, the coming together after a struggle. It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia, and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination. We seek a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement-making between governments and First Nations, and truth-telling about our history. In 1967, we were counted. In 2017, we seek to be heard. We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country. We invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future.
Thank you very much, Stan. It's a powerful statement, and it's emotional, and it is definitely from the heart, and you can hear that. For people who've heard that for the first time, Megan, I'd like to just bring you in, and maybe if you could just talk to us, what is the crux of what comes out of this statement? And I suggest that it comes down to that call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. What can you just explain for people who might be hearing that for the first time? What does that actually mean? Does it mean we just add a few words into the Constitution? and if that's all it is, why is that necessary?
Yeah, it is, I suppose, effectively about adding a few words to the Constitution. In this case, what we're seeking is quite a simple, modest provision to be added to the Constitution that enables the federal parliament to pass a law to set up a new First Nations representative body, which will be the institution that governments and bureaucrats need to consult with when they're making laws and policies about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's lives. You know, our very simple ask, which is at the crux of the Uluru Statement, is when you talk about us and when you make laws and policies about us, they are going to be more effective if we're actually at the table involved in those conversations. And I think over the past 2 years since the Uluru Statement was issued, the invitation was issued to the Australian people, Australians are increasingly shocked at the fact that it's no exaggeration to say often we're actually not at the table at all. Most of the laws are made by bureaucrats and policies are made by bureaucrats in Canberra and in regional areas, and there's not many Aboriginal eyes or involvement at all in those conversations. And that's why they're struggling to make any impacts upon disadvantage.
It would be a commission similar to the Productivity Commission there to offer independent, informed advice to the Parliament. Is that right?
The voice to Parliament is in the process, of course, of being designed in terms of what it would look like. Some kind of productivity feature may be a feature of that. But the reforms in the Uluru Statement are a sequenced reform, meaning the voice to Parliament, the referendum change comes first, the structural reform. And then it will be the voice to Parliament that sets up the Makarrata Commission that goes on to do work such as supervising agreements between First Nations and governments, creating a naming and renaming commission in which we seek the dual naming of Australian towns and cities and significant sites. The Uluru dialogues felt very strongly about the nature of Aboriginal presence in the physical environment. And the Makarrata Commission will do that and much of other work in the Aboriginal domain around fast-tracking of land rights, land claims and native title claims and other things. It has a really core function in keeping government accountable, but the primary function is to elevate the voice of people on the ground in what we call grassroots communities directly to Canberra without any filter.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I mean, it is just a voice. It's not a body that will be able to introduce laws or suggest laws or, you know, vote on them. It's not that powerful.
No. It's not possible to be that because that would be unconstitutional. The dialogues were very structured dialogues that were led by Aboriginal people but had very serious input from constitutional lawyers around the country. And, you know, in talking about the reforms, people were utterly cognizant of the constitutional limitations of any such voice, such as the fact that we have a doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, which means that no body we create can bind the parliament. And the dialogues are well aware of that. The urgency of the reform meant that people thought an upfront political empowerment, which is what this is, empowering our people, will create really significant political change and create political tension in a way that, you know, renders this body really a very important and powerful institution within the framework of Australia's democratic system. So it's certainly not a body that's going to be able to just veto and override anything. It's simply not possible. You couldn't do that because it would be unconstitutional.
Yes, and Stan, if I can bring you in maybe on the politics of this, you know, we had the statement and immediately Malcolm Turnbull came out and said that he didn't think it was a good idea. In his constitutional law opinion, I'm not sure what qualifications he had on that front, it would create a third chamber of parliament in effect.
It was very misleading.
Yes.
Because it wasn't going to have the reach of a third chamber of parliament. Clearly, it wasn't going to be that.
Why do you think that he did that? Is this just something that is not something that a conservative government wants to advance?
I think there are two answers to that. One is there is a political answer, and that is that Malcolm Turnbull was dealing with a very fractured and divided party. His leadership was weakened, and he was battling the right flank of his own party. So to take on another battle, to fight a battle for Indigenous Australia, was not in his political interests in terms of his own political survival. Of course, he lost his prime ministership in any event, but there was an internal political reality that he was battling with. Beyond that, there is an ideological roadblock to this. Now, the third chamber was not accurate, but it does go to something much more deeply embedded in the conservative political psyche. And you can go back to John Howard, when John Howard first put forward at a referendum the idea of recognising Indigenous people in the Constitution in some form of preamble, some poetic words that acknowledge the place of Indigenous people in Australia. And he said that Indigenous people have a special but not separate place in Australia. I think there is something deeply ideological in conservative politics that says in a liberal democracy, it is premised on the rights of individuals, not on group rights. And making that leap from what is essentially a commitment to the freedom and the liberty and the rights of individuals to acknowledging the rights of a particular group can be a bridge too far for the conservative side of politics. And I think this is a reality that Indigenous leadership face in being able to shift that immovable object, if you like. And Megan has very calmly and very simply laid out how the Indigenous aspirations here sit very comfortably within a liberal democratic framework and within the Australian Constitution. New Zealand, the United States, Canada, parts of Europe have all acknowledged within their liberal democracies the place of Indigenous peoples, First Peoples, Native peoples, and their particular group rights, which relate to their sovereignty and their place, unique place, in their countries. It is not beyond Australia to do that either. Now, Megan has laid out that our Constitution is a very utilitarian document. It is a document that is a rules-based document, not a rights-based document. And what the Uluru Statement from the Heart with the Voice sets out is that here is something that is very consistent with a rules-based document. How does something operate? How does it function? What are its impact? For a group of people for whom exists unique status in Australia, unique rights in Australia, native title being one of them, land rights, a whole cascade of issues that tumble from those rights, and also a group of people for whom the federal parliament has the right and does make laws specifically for. Now, that is a very different status to the rest of Australians. So you can join the group rights or the group aspirations of Indigenous people in a document like the Australian Constitution that is perfectly consistent with our liberal democratic framework and which acknowledges the political realities that Indigenous people live under in Australia. It's very simple, really.
Yeah, Megan, perhaps, you know, if we're talking from a pragmatic point of view, could you speak to the cost of not getting this right? I mean, we are deploying taxpayer resources, you know, to help communities. If we're not actually getting input from those communities as to how best to spend the money, you know, that is an argument for people to say, well, why wouldn't we force the government to sort of listen to what actually might make those programs effective? Do we have a large problem at the moment with the sorts of programs that are being rolled out not actually delivering what everyone would hope that they would, which is sort of more empowerment for the communities that they're targeted at?
Yeah, look, I think that there is a substantial amount of taxpayer funding that is aimed at and targeted at Aboriginal communities, but not a lot of it hits the ground. And that's one of the key problems that we have. A lot is spent on bureaucratic functions and institutions in addition to administrative funds. But worse than that, at the moment, and this is particularly, I think, why the dialogues really spoke about voicelessness and powerlessness, a government program was introduced when Tony Abbott came into office called the Indigenous Advancement Strategy. And what the government did there was just take all of the black money across all of the bureaucracies, all the departments, and put it into one bucket. And in doing that, they asked people to reapply for the money and cut, you know, hundreds and thousands of programs that operate in communities, some very successful programs that operated since post-Whitlam. And what you saw then post-Abbott was this slow dismantling of the Aboriginal domain and any degree of community control and autonomy. So what that money was put into a bucket, and then everyone was asked to apply. So communities applied. The bulk of the money went to non-Indigenous organisations. They went to big corporations with reconciliation action plans who applied for money in the bucket to fund their RAP initiatives. I think it was something like the first round of IAS, 70% went to not-for-profits, you know, big NGOs, and only about, I think, 40% to 30% actually went to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. Now, that policy is in place, but it has really gutted the sector. And so you can see when, you know, AFL and NRL and Swimming Australia and then departments, you know, the Northern Territory departments and even the Commonwealth Department of Science, I think, all applying to this IAS money that used to, you know, go out to the communities and fund, you know, whether it was a health program or some of the night patrols that Aboriginal women had created and innovated in terms of combating domestic violence. Like, all of this money now went to other initiatives in non-Indigenous organisations that weren't aimed at our welfare or well-being. There are two very important Australian National Audit Office reports that have come out in the past year that now vindicate what all of the mob were saying in the dialogues about the arbitrary nature of the decision-making around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander money and how that a lot of that money isn't actually going into Aboriginal hands. So, you know, you look at a place like Yarrabah just outside of Cairns, and they lost a whole raft of their projects. They don't even get IAS money. But what they do have now is Save the Children, for example, coming in from Cairns and delivering the programs that they used to deliver to their own people. So there's a real problem there. It is one of the key, I think, drivers of why The Voice was ranked number one of all communities. Because even with the IAS to one side for the past 10 years, I think the state has shown they're incapable of closing the gap in disadvantage in many indicators, whether it's health or education, especially in the area of incarceration and justice targets. And what we're saying is, look, we don't know where you're putting all this money. We don't, you know, you don't assess it properly. But it's not effective because we're not having a say in this at all. And if we want to close the gap and we want to empower our people, give us a voice and put us back in control of the policies that impact upon our people, because we know our people, we live among them. We know what the problems are. People in Canberra who are making the decisions have often never even been into an Aboriginal community.
Yeah, it's a really compelling argument that you make. And it's important to note as well that the statement has the support of a lot of institutions in society. The Law Council has signed up, Australian Medical Association, the Business Council, lots of law firms, the big mining companies, investment banks, everyone is sort of saying this is the way forward. Stan, how ready do you think Australians really are to take this next step forward?
I think they're very ready. I think Australians have moved a long way, and that this is a call for a movement of the Australian people. This was never directed at politicians. This was an acknowledgement that this is about completing us as a nation. The most powerful, the most resoundingly successful referendum in Australian history was 1967, when there were two very technical questions asked. One was counting Indigenous people in the census. The other was allowing the federal parliament to make laws for Indigenous people. But it was more than that. It was a grassroots movement, a door-knocking movement around the idea of fairness. It was about a fair go. It was who we are as Australians. And I think fundamentally this is too. There are constitutional arguments, there are political and legal arguments, there are a whole range of ramifications that will come from this and hopefully to better policy outcomes. But I think it is at another level, even more profound, in that it completes the idea of Australia. By centering Indigenous people at the heart of the founding document of the nation, the Constitution, in embedding Australian national identity in 60,000+ years of history, not just two centuries, it gives us a greater sense of who we are as a people. It is, as Indigenous people have often said, finishing the unfinished business. So I think this keeps faith with 1967. In that it is fundamentally about fairness, a fair go. Is this not reasonable that the first peoples excluded and historically discriminated against should finally have a centrality in our national founding document and a capacity to deal directly with the issues that affect those communities? It doesn't mean we are separate. It doesn't mean that we don't go to the same football grounds on the weekend and cheer for the same teams and work alongside other Australians and send our children to school alongside other Australians and live with and have relationships with and marry people from all different backgrounds. That's who we are. But it centres all of us in this connection to something deep and ongoing and spiritual. And I think that is a profound story for the nation, as well as being a well overdue political, constitutional, legal change that we need to make.
Yeah, I think the statement says it's a gift to the nation.
It's a gift.
It really is a gift and that we can all enjoy and get value from.
And how remarkable. I find this just astonishing. It is the thing as a member of the Referendum Council with Megan, and I want to pay tribute to the work that Megan and particularly Pat Anderson did on this. They led this process. To go out to these communities and talk to people who have every reason to say, well, to hell with the idea of Australia. Look at the way we've been treated. And what did we get? We got generosity. Not a clenched fist, but an open hand. That is a remarkable gift to this country.
Yeah, and important timing too, because next year is the year that marks 250 years since the landing of James Cook and that chapter in Australian history. What a moment for us to get ahead of that and also celebrate, you know, a more continuous notion of ourselves as a nation that didn't just start 250 years ago.
I think there's some synergy there, actually.
Yeah,
I think in saying, who are we? This is not 1770. It's not 1970. Australia has moved. And Indigenous people have changed Australia. We've protested, we've taken to the streets, we've battled through the courts, we've battled through the parliaments. We get up every day and Indigenous people drive trucks and teach schools and work in hospitals and dig ditches. And we have always done this. We have fought in the wars and we have helped build the country. And we are, if that's a tribute to the quiet Australians at the last election, we are often the quietest Australians, the Australians whom most Australians never even meet. And we get up every day and try to make the country a better country against often overwhelming odds. So 1967 and the 1992 Mabo decision and the 2007 apology to the Stolen Generations and the profound words of the Uluru Statement, they sit in a continuum of Australian history that dates back 60,000 years and includes the arrival of Captain Cook up until today. What better time is there than next year in 250 years since Cook's arrival, when two peoples met on this land, that we move closer to the idea of saying now we are a people? What better time?
And Megan, what is the sense that you have from within the sort of people that you talk to as to what momentum this actually has? What chances there are that a Morrison government would be the one that would get us towards a referendum?
I think people are pretty positive. I mean, you know, Scott Morrison has said some really encouraging things. And of course, we now have Ken Wyatt, who is the first Aboriginal person to hold the post of Indigenous Affairs Minister. We were able to get the Referendum Council, the Kirribilli meeting and the Uluru Statement all under an LNP government. We have to work with either side of politics if we're going to make big law reform like this. You know, even though Labor had committed to a first-term referendum, there was never any guarantee that was going to occur. We all know that politicians often say they'll do things and they don't. And we remember, I think, Hawke's commitment to treaty and national land rights, and that didn't come about. So we've always proceeded on the basis as if this will happen. And it's really just a 24/7 thing from each day to day, just forging ahead and building that people's movement. Part of issuing the Uluru Statement to the Australian people was to say, look, this is big law reform. Often governments don't think beyond 3-year terms. We know that we're coming from an era of policy and law inertia when it comes to reform in Australia. Therefore, we thought if we're ever going to make this change, this structural change that we feel is absolutely necessary to empower our people, then we have to work with Australian people. It, you know, just ordinary Aussies in sporting clubs, and you've got to just get out, start having a cup of teas and yarning with Aussies and just getting this reform done, because it's not going to get done through conventional processes like parliamentary committees and lobbying politicians. It has to be Aussies working together.
Look, it is something that seems to be getting momentum, and I thank you both for both coming in and talking to us about it today, and for all the work that you've done in advancing this cause. Hopefully this is something that the time has come, and as you say, everyone can feel a sense of ownership of this, and as something that can happen for our nation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Stan Grant is the Professor of Global Affairs at Griffith University, and Megan Davis is Director of the Indigenous Law Centre at the University of New South Wales. Now, just a quick plug for our end of financial year sale for subscriptions. Subscribers allow us to tell stories that matter and fund podcasts like this one. And until June 30, subscriptions to The Herald or The Age are half price, with offers starting from as little as $1.75 per week. If you've been umming and ahhing about a subscription, now's the time to finally sign up. You'll get access to a range of subscriber benefits like unlimited story access, no more paywalls, weekend paper deliveries, special events, and exclusive behind-the-scenes content. Help power our newsroom and fund the future of independent journalism. Just visit our homepage and click on the subscribe link at the top. Joining me now is Lisa Davies, the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jess.
It's not very often I have to interview my boss.
No pressure.
Bit of pressure. I just wanted you to tell us, what is it that the Herald has done this week and why?
So this week we launched a campaign, I guess you could call it, to really start a national conversation about some momentum for Indigenous recognition. This has obviously been a topic of conversation around and about for a long, long time. And for me personally, I guess I became pretty interested in the issue a few months ago. I did a lot of reading and I was talking to some people who have worked a lot in this space. And I was quite struck by a very simple concept that, you know, we celebrate our multicultural achievements in this country. You know, we are one of the most successful multicultural nations in the world. You know, we also, of course, are hugely proud of our, you know, the European settlement, a British settlement. And, you know, I feel like there's that third plank missing, and it's something that Noel Pearson talks about a lot. I think there's this lovely quote, "We stand on the cusp of bringing our ancient heritage together with those other two parts." And what a wonderful achievement that would be to really celebrate those three planks of our nation as a national story that we can all be proud of. It feels like something that is long overdue, that as a nation we should have this important conversation and not just keep letting it be overtaken by other issues that are potentially more divisive. I think this could be a really unifying one.
And what is it from an editorial point of view that we have decided to call for?
Specifically, we are saying, or we said in our editorial on Monday, that we believe there should be a voice. There should be constitutional recognition of Indigenous Australians enshrined in this concept of the voice. I think what that looks like specifically is not for me or anyone at the Herald to really say. So the Indigenous community and the leaders of those communities need to educate us on what it should look like. I think there are a lot of options, how it could be formed, how, you know, whether we do a referendum based on broad principles or else a more specific model can be reached for that to be voted on by the Australian people. But I think broadly we just believe that the time has come for us to recognise our incredible ancient culture that we have here. And if the Herald can be a place for mature discussion and people can voice their own ideas and ways to celebrate, then, you know, I hope that's a really good thing.
I think our slogan used to be start a conversation. It's now is independent always.
Yep.
Some people might question why we, as a newspaper, we're supposed to be independent always, would sort of choose to pick a side, I guess, and we are sort of saying that the statement, the Uluru statement, we're endorsing essentially the conclusion of that.
Definitely.
How do you think about that as our role as independent journalists to actually be now pushing agenda?
I think newspapers and media organisations have a role to play in facilitating discussion. That's obviously a primary function. But I also think that we are we are in a unique position of being able to lead discussion as well. I don't want to tell people what to think. I don't think that's our job, but I think we can frame conversations around positive outcomes. Newspapers, I mean, you know, listeners might be familiar with various campaigns that other organisations have done under a previous editor here. For example, some years ago, made some very clear statements around climate change, like we accept the science, we accept that man-made climate change is real. Every day in the newspaper, we write editorials. Now, people say, oh, that's the editor's view. It's actually not my view. I obviously oversee the writing of them and I, you know, approve that. But it's the Herald's view. Now, the Herald's view is a lot bigger than me. And I know that distinction might sound weird in 2019, but, you know, the Sydney Morning Herald has been around for 188 years and we have been advising, I guess, and guiding discussions and leading conversations for all of that time. So there's our own heritage to draw on as to what we believe is appropriate to sort of advise people. People don't have to believe it or follow what we say or agree with us, but I think it's a positioning that is useful to sort of ground conversation with.
Okay, well, we've certainly given some air time to this topic this week, and I think it's been a good exercise to sort of give some voice to what Stan Grant was talking about in his editorial as the quietest Australians who often don't get the voice in the newspaper. And I'm conscious of that we don't have as many Indigenous voices as perennially, you know, quoted in the paper. You know,
this has been an incredibly gratifying week, I have to say. The readers and people beyond the Herald have been overwhelmingly incredibly supportive of us taking this stand and really putting this up the priority list. And, you know, I'm personally very encouraged by the sentiments of the Prime Minister saying that he also wants an outcome on this. And, you know, if it takes a long time, well, I mean, it's taken a long time already. If it takes a long time, that's fine. We need to get there, and we need to get there in a way that all Australians can get behind. And I think, you know, as a campaign, it's probably not an easy one to firstly to sort of try and do, because as I say, like it can be a very divisive issue. But I think overarchingly, if we can maintain civility, listen to the people. I mean, Stan Grant himself said something to me a while ago about, you know, it's fine to ask the questions, like to ask each other questions, but we have to also listen to the answers. So that's what I hope that we at the Herald here will be doing, posing questions, starting discussion, but also listening to each other.
Lisa Davies is the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. Thanks to our guests this week, Stan Grant, Megan Davis and Lisa Davies. Tory Maguire will be back in the hosting chair again soon after a well-earned post-election break. The team is really enjoying hearing your feedback. You're welcome to get in touch with us anytime with comments or questions. Our email is in the show notes. And thanks to the team behind this week's episode, especially to Amelia Maguire, our hero this week, who helped to organise all the logistics for this episode despite being struck down by illness. Thanks for going over and above, Amelia. Rachel Dexter produced and edited this episode, and David McMillan and Yuji Shimada take care of our studio recordings. Tom McKendrick is head of audio at The Age and The Herald. We're going to leave you now with a snippet of a recent TED Talk by Indigenous leader Dean Parkin, who was one of the signatories to the Uluru Statement. Here he is describing just what an emotional process it was and his hope for the future. I'm Jess Irvine. Thanks for listening.
In this moment of such importance to my peoples and my nation, I felt a tiredness in my bones and in my soul. I was utterly spent. And then I reflected on everything that had happened to get to this point. My job was to capture the stories of more than 1,200 people as they gave their hearts and their minds to the dialogues. Standing at the front of the room at each of the dialogues, I could hear and feel the passion, the grief, the hope, the challenges, and the ideas of people who had spent decades striving for change. Truth-telling is not about apportioning blame or generating guilt, but it is the clear realisation that deep reconciliation in this country is impossible without also knowing and naming the truth of our shared history. This is our moment to make our own history, one that acknowledges the past properly and imagines a greater future.